Addiction is a disease that does not discriminate, and we really need to recognize that it is in all of our communities all across this country.
And I remember looking around, and there was these women with black eyes and puking and going to the bathroom on themselves, you know, heroin withdrawal. And I remember looking around and being like, I don't belong here. This is not me. I am not like these people. I need to get out of here. You know, and that's crazy because down the road, that became me.
Addiction, how can it be a choice? Who would choose to be desperate? Who would choose to have their backs against the wall? Who would choose not to have a life? Who would choose to lose their children? Who would choose these things, you know?
I wasn't doing really anything outside of what people my age were doing. Most people were doing very similar things. It's just when I would drink, I would go above and beyond. There's a saying, you know, in sobriety that you're the last to know.
You know, we've seen the shift from heroin to fentanyl and fentanyl to carfentanil and these synthetic opiates that are coming out on the market that are killing people, that are much harder to reverse with Narcan.
A lieutenant, I don't know his name, remember his name, he grabbed me towards the my bottom, and he said, you don't belong here, Tim. You got to get your life back together. You got a problem right now, and you shouldn't be at this bar.
I remember her stating that her friends threw in the alley like trash. And I left that meeting, and I cried for 2 days, because I know that had to be horrible. And even now, it's just to see my child in that kind of pain, and to even carry that she's seen me doing that stuff first, you know, and then it caused her to have that kind of pain, that was a lot to deal with.
The pain that I felt 4.5 years ago, when I think about it, I still feel that. And I think if I ever lost it, that would be a very dangerous place for me to be, because that's what keeps me clean.
Personal stories of addiction and recovery in the Chicago area. It's Extension 720 tonight on 720 WGN.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight. Beautiful night in Chicago. A little cold, but that's okay. I think we can handle. No socks tonight, so you got us. Extension 720 till 10 o'clock. Big show tonight. A couple of years ago, I was hosting The Download. I got pitched a story about a man who was getting over his heroin addiction. He had been clean for about a year or so. Did we want to do a story and interview him about his story? I did. I got some really amazing feedback. And because his story wasn't unique, it was instead relatable. It wasn't the stereotypical story told on the movie screens and TV shows of our time. Instead, it was a story that you felt could happen to you. We got a powerful show tonight. We've partnered with the Gateway Foundation, a not-for-profit treatment center, to dive deep into the world of drug and alcohol abuse. We talk addiction. We talk recovery. And all the things that happen in between. The stories you'll hear tonight are real. They're raw. They're powerful. They're told by those who lived through it all and ended up on the other side striving to live a sober life. I'm not one for trigger warnings, but there's strong adult language and situations in tonight's program. But I don't want to paint a picture that the stories you're going to hear are dark and depressing. Far from it. Yes, the journey to sobriety can be bleak. But at the end of the day, these stories are uplifting ones that show that when the days are darkest, there still can be light. Addiction is a scourge, and tonight we hear about it firsthand. But we also want to shine a light on the work that's being done to fight addiction and for addiction. What does that mean? Well, the folks at Gateway are doing God's work when it comes to helping people get back on their feet. But they're also fighting on another front, to rid society of the stigma of shame and embarrassment and guilt. To reclassify substance abuse as less a moral weakness and more a medical disorder, one that should be studied and funded alongside diabetes and heart conditions. Sure, strides are being made, but they're slow. We'll talk about what the counselors are seeing in their facilities, new drugs, new treatments, new patients. We'll do that coming up after the 7:30 news. But the main focus tonight, my guests who are brave enough to come in studio and tell us the harrowing details of the fight of their lives. And all the stories are both similar and unique at the same time. Take, for instance, Jessica. Jessica grew up in the western suburbs, and at a pretty young age, she got pregnant. Maybe too young of an age. Because she saw drugs as a way of an escape. But quickly she got wrapped up in heroin, found it almost impossible to escape. Even though pregnant with her second baby, she had to. Or how about another story about a mom who found herself in pain after a routine surgery? Not just one doctor prescribed her pain pills, but all the doctors did. According to Pam, 10 doctors were prescribing her opioids. Naturally, she got addicted. She did so with her kids watching. Her youngest daughter, Melissa, followed in her mom's footsteps. Together, they tell their story tonight. And Chicago's been home to some legendary drunks, stars of stage and screen like John Belushi and Chris Farley. My friend Tim was there. He was on the Second City stage hoping to get his break, hiding or not hiding his drug and alcohol addiction, hoping nothing more than to follow in his friend's footsteps to Saturday Night Live. That call never came, and Tim fell deeper and deeper into an abyss. Through treatment, he found his way out and continues to tell his story to a comedy community that can attract and idolize addicts. And these stories are not just for the old and the wise among us. Connor, he's only 25 years old. And after a series of mishaps and blackouts, he recognized he had a problem. His story is similar to a lot of young men and women who are growing up in a culture that promotes and even pushes substances. Connor tells his story of how he came to the realization at a very young age. All those stories tonight on Extension 720. This is episode 19, and we're going to call it A Long Way Back to the Light.
Blacking in and out in a strange flat in East London. Somebody I don't really know just gave me something to help settle me down and to stop me from always thinking about you. And you know your life is heading in a questionable direction when you're up for days of strangers and you can't remember anything except the way you sounded when you told me you didn't know what I should do. Like every other day, and just like every boring blues song, I get swallowed by the pain, and so I fumble for your figure in the darkness just to make it go away. But you're not lying there any longer, and I know that that's my fault. So I've been pounding on the floor, and I've been crawling up the walls, and I've been dipping in my darkness with serotonin boosters, cider, and some kind of smelling salts. So I'm out up to recover. Well, darling, let's make a deal. If anybody ever asks us, let's just tell them that we met in jail. And that's a story that I'm sticking to like a stone you phrased to compass. But tonight I need to hear some truth if I'm ever getting through this. Yeah, you once sent me a letter that said if you're lost at sea, close your eyes and catch a time, my dear, and only think of me. Well, darling, now I'm sinking and I'm as lost and lost could be. And I was hoping you could drag me up and down here towards my recovery.
Stories of addiction and recovery tonight on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight we tackle the issue of addiction and recovery, a hard topic for sure, but one that's made harder by the stigma attached, the stigma of shame and guilt and embarrassment. That falling victim to addiction is not a medical condition, but a choice, a moral behavioral choice. The truth is only 10% of people who are struggling with alcohol or substance abuse seek treatment. That means 90% of people affected are hiding it or making a choice not to get clean. Tonight, we hear stories of addiction and the process of treatment and recovery. We share the stories of professionals, but also the stories of those who lived through it, how addiction ripped through their lives, and how they picked up the pieces. Tonight, we've teamed up with the Gateway Foundation, a not-for-profit that offers substance abuse treatment across the region. But the truth is, there are several organizations that do this work and continue to be on the front lines, saving lives and confronting the stigma that sometimes is as troubling as the addiction itself. Jim Scarpese is the executive director at Gateway in both Aurora and Joliet.
We know this is a medical condition. We know this is an illness that affects the brain. Actually, the American Medical Association has known that since the 50s. So it's not a new revelation, if you will, yet unlike other medical conditions, this one has never really been treated as such. I think part of it is because it's an illness that affects the brain, it looks behavioral. It looks like choice. It looks like people are choosing to use drugs, choosing to use alcohol, choosing to have those substances negatively impact their relationships, their lives, their careers. But it isn't about choice, you know. And I think because unlike medical conditions like cancer and heart disease that you can see more affect the body, because this affects more of the brain, people don't fully understand it. So that's one big piece. The other piece is, you know, the language we use around this. You know, when I do trainings in the community, one of the things I talk about is if I went to my doctor and he told me I had early stage prostate cancer, right? And I went in to see an oncologist, I would never say to that oncologist, if he asked me why I'm here, I would never say I'm here because I'm cancer.
Scarpese and his colleagues like Karen Wallenek-Albert, an executive director for Lake County, are not only treating the illness, but they're fighting to make people more aware of what the illness is.
Addiction is a disease that does not discriminate, and we really need to recognize that it is in all of our communities all across this country. And really, it's a chronic relapsing brain disease. You know, I think the years where people really looked at addiction as a moral failing or that something was wrong with a person, hopefully our research is showing that we're moving beyond that and showing us that a substance use disorder is really a chronic disease like diabetes or a heart condition or other things. And from a public health perspective, we need to treat it as such if we're going to save more lives.
Addiction, how can it be a choice?
That's Tekoa Judaway. She supervises the Women Aspire program at Gateway.
Who would choose to be desperate? Who would choose to have their backs against the wall? Who would choose not to have a life? Who would choose to lose their children? Who would choose these things, you know? So absolutely, it's not a choice. And that's why they come into treatment, because they have no choice.
But for all the stigma, treatment and recovery is evolving. Here's Jim Scarpese.
We employ nursing 24/7. We have doctors. We have master's level therapists, really trying to treat the condition both comprehensively from a medical standpoint as well as a research informed standpoint. So medication assisted treatment. Now we know in 2019 and really for the last several years that there are effective medications to help people with both alcohol use disorder and substance use disorder manage their withdrawals, their cravings, some of the things that put them at risk for relapse. We also know psychologically that there's a strong relationship between substance use disorder and mental health issues like depression and anxiety and mood disorders, that history of trauma can impact putting someone at risk for relapse. So really treating the disorder holistically.
But as treatment evolves, so do the drugs and the addictions.
You know, we've seen the shift from heroin to fentanyl and fentanyl to carfentanil and these synthetic opiates that are coming out on the market that are killing people, that are much harder to reverse with Narcan, which is the opioid reversal medication that, you know, law enforcement as well as medical providers use. It doesn't work as well because they're synthetic, because they're so much more potent.
Again, Karen Wallenek-Albert.
More and more of the people that we see in our treatment centers are involved with many substances, from alcohol to marijuana. We've seen a big increase in prescription pills. And of course, we hear about the opioid epidemic and now really the third wave of the opioid epidemic, where we see these synthetic opioids and we see fentanyl. And one of the things that I think it's important for people to know is we're not just seeing fentanyl in heroin. We're seeing fentanyl in all kinds of things. There's a lot of pressed pills that are out on the street right now that are being sold to people as stimulants or pain pills or even benzodiazepines like Xanax. And those pills are containing fentanyl in them. We've even heard from some of our law enforcement partners that they found batches of marijuana that contain fentanyl. Mm. And certainly fentanyl is leading to a lot of the fatal overdoses that we're seeing here and really all over the country.
But treatment and recovery is not easy. It's a battle. More often than the counselors want, patients suffer relapses. And believe it or not, that takes its toll on the counselors. Again, Tekoa Judaway.
It's sad, right? Because you want people to get it. But there's no way I'm going to say, don't come back.
you know, maybe this time you'll get it, maybe on the third time, maybe on the eighth time. Keep coming back until you get it, because I know you can get it. I know people can get it. I've seen it done too many times. So it can be disheartening, but I'm not giving up. We don't give up at Gateway Foundation.
This idea of getting it, what does that mean? What does it mean to get it?
To gain the recovery skills you need for life, to stay sober, to make a decision not only to pick up the tools that we give at Gateway Foundation, but also to use those tools to utilize a lifetime of sobriety, to utilize those skills to live, to know what it is to live what they say a normal life. You know, so many people want that, to get it. To get what it is. How can I go to the show without getting high? How can I go to dinner without getting high? You know, the so-called normal things. I remember when people would say, I used to like to eat. I stopped liking to eat food. Oh my God. I used to like to go shopping with my parents. You know, things like that. Normal things. So to get it. Yeah. To stay clean.
But the work being done at places like Gateway and others is just the tip of the iceberg. As the White House prioritized fighting opioid addictions and the companies that got us here, and more local governments are creating task forces to fight the epidemic, there could be light at the end of the tunnel. But as Jim Scarpese notes, even as the medical community is coming around, there's still a long way to go.
I hope so. And I think the ball starting to roll on that right now. It's just slow. Doctors' offices are asking questions now. They're starting to do screenings, asking some very important questions about substance use or history of it. They're asking questions now about family history of alcohol use or substance use. It's just slow moving. And unlike other medical conditions where we've been able to pick up the pace and move much more quickly and effectively, because of the stigmas, because of the misperceptions about this, we're not moving as quickly as we need to. From physicians to the legal components or legal sectors of the community, to the schools, to the families, to the private therapists.
They all understand.
They all understand what this is, and really helping people come forward and get assistance with it, not feeling ashamed or afraid or guilty about saying, hey, I'm struggling with this. Because you wouldn't do that with other conditions, but with this, it's just a natural inclination to hide it.
Tonight, we bring you personal stories of some Chicagoans that have lived through the hell that is substance abuse and lived to tell their tale to others. Stay with us. is the phone number. 708 says, glad you're on the air about this. I'm a 31-year-old addict, alcoholic, been to Florida numerous times for treatment, live in the South Chicagoland area. Glad to hear someone like this on the radio in my town. Thank you very much. That's nice. Let's go to Gene. Gene's on the line. Let's talk about it. Gene, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you says here you're in the medical profession. You've been sober for 30-plus years.
Actually, I'm a certified nurse anesthetist. And I went into treatment in 1986.
Wow.
And I went in for alcoholism. And I was way ahead of my time because one of my other drugs was fentanyl. And that was because I was using it in my anesthetics. And whatever was left over, I put in a vial and kept it for myself.
When you hear we talking to the Gateway counselors about fentanyl and how that is becoming the next sort of designer drug or the what you're seeing more alongside drugs like heroin and marijuana, does that scare you as someone who knows it?
I do know it. I was in anesthesia training when a drug called Inavar, which was a combination of droperidol and fentanyl came out. Mm-hmm. And so I know, you know, China's making it now. It's not coming from the United States.
Yeah.
You know, it's China that it's coming from. And I don't think you ever know the strength that you're getting from China.
Hmm. Thanks for sharing, Gene. I appreciate it. Okay, there you go. Yeah, I don't know much about the drugs that are on the streets right now, but to hear Karen and others in the piece talk about fentanyl being
one of the drugs that's being used in combination with heroin or with, as Karen mentioned, even marijuana. That's where it gets really scary for people who may understand only what they understand, meaning they may know what their doses are when they're thinking of their specific drugs. But when you're adding something, as Gene mentioned, as you know, industry grade as fentanyl to your drug of choice, that could be very, very dangerous, if not fatal. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. As we talk, we get ready, coming up here in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to start with a couple of stories about recovery and about addiction. We're going to start with Jessica's story. Jessica, a woman from the western suburbs, talks about her story of getting addicted to heroin and the difficulties of getting off of heroin and the effect it had on her and her family. That's coming up. Also, some really detailed descriptions about jail. And, you know, a lot of times, and this is a different time, you know, these are alumni of Gateway. This is not someone who is, you know, addicted to heroin right now in 2019. There are different ways to get it in different places. You don't have to do it like a lot of users did in the last couple decades, where you had to get on 290 or the Kennedy and come downtown, stop off where you have at whatever street corner you know, and get back on the highway to go home. Life has changed in the way that now you can get it in your own town, in your own area. But yeah, that used to be a big thing to, you know, obviously the drugs that were being sold at some of the housing projects. No, that was, I did a documentary at Stateway Gardens before they tore it down at 35th and State. And the residents talked about how every day there was almost like a flood of white teenagers who would come in from the suburbs and park in the little parking lot that was at Stateway Garden that was mostly administrative, that, you know, there's only 10 spots in there or whatever. But people be parking and walking through the quad, and people knew exactly what they were there for. And that's something that you would see over and over and over every single day, almost like a turnstile. And that's the same story that you hear in this story coming up with Jessica, and you hear from so many countless former addicts about where they got it from. But that's changed. Also coming up, we're going to talk with Tim O'Malley. Tim is he's a comedy. He's been a comedy legend. Legend's a weird word. I don't like to use it because that usually means somebody who has entertained the masses. But when it comes to the Chicago community, Tim has been there since the 80s. And Tim was on stage at Second City hoping desperately to both make it to Saturday Night Live and hide what was a pretty strong dependency and addiction to alcohol and drugs. But in the comedy community, there's this weird thing where, not unlike other art forms, whether it be writers and actors and others, there's this almost like worshiping at the idol of drug use and drug addicts. And that plays, I know this very well from being my days in improv and sketch comedy, where there was this idolizing of the John Belushis or the Del Closes or the Chris Farleys even, who seemed to use drugs as a way to harness their genius, almost to take their chaos and their genius to the next level, and they did. Obviously, those are very cautionary tales and tales of burnout and flameouts and death and destruction. But it's something that a lot of people, because they're attracted to that for whatever chemical reason, they come into comedy. They feel like that's them. They want to be John Belushi. They want to be the next John Belushi. And so they get caught up in that world very quick, and it's there. That is a late night world. And they want to live like their idols lived. And that's something that Tim went through.
and had to deal with and had to get sober. He told a lot about it in the show, The God Show, which was a huge hit at Second City back in 2000s. And he continues to teach and tell his story. So we'll have that coming up as well in the 8 o'clock hour. In the 9 o'clock hour, we've got more. Pam and Melissa, mother-daughter combo, talking about how addiction runs through the family, but also about the pain and suffering of watching both your mom and watching your daughter go through addiction. And we'll talk with Connor. Connor, a young man, now 25 years old, 2 years ago, 23 years old, recognizing through missteps and run-ins with the law and a hospital stay that he had a problem. And even though the world around him supported it and you know, this is a young culture and almost not only promoted but pushed it, he had to make a choice. He chose his life. So we'll talk with Connor as well coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. All that's coming up tonight, Extension 720. Stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman, and this is episode 19, which we're calling A Long Way Back to the Light, Stories of Addiction and Recovery in the Chicago Area. So let's get to it. Our first story tonight, Jessica. Jessica grew up in the western suburbs, but she had to grow up fast as she got pregnant at a pretty young age. And unfortunately, she found drugs, too. At a young age, she was already trying to hide a heroin addiction from her parents. She would take 290, the heroin highway, into the city and back home. It's a story that includes addiction, jail, relapse, disappointment, anger, and redemption. And as a trigger warning, it can be graphic. Here's Jessica.
I was 19. I was in my first year of college. And I had got it from a friend of mine. I had really bad cramps, and I walked into his house, and I said, "Do you have any Tylenol?" And he said, "No, but I've got something else for you." And he held out some foils in his hand, and he gave them to me. And there was six of us all that tried it for our first time that day. Everybody got sick. You know, the reaction from doing the heroin, you know, you get sick, you throw up, kind of people, you know, that would do morphine or something. It makes you nauseous. And everybody else is like, "No, I'm never doing this again." And me, I liked how it made me feel. And I'm like, I love it. This is great. I had been hanging around with a rough crowd and doing drugs and drinking since an early age, since I was 12 years old. It's kind of just what we did, you know, but I had heard of heroin, but I didn't really know anything about it. And I used to think, like, you know, needles, you know, things like that. And the fact that I was snorting it, and, you know, I started off just doing it on the weekends. Once I had found out that you were able to drive to Chicago off of 290 and get it, you know, heroin highway and stuff like that, you know, the bets were kind of off at that point. I could come get it whenever I wanted to. And I didn't really realize what I was messing with until I didn't have it. And I remember getting up one day to go to school, and I felt like I was sick, like I had the flu. And I'm like, what is the matter with me? And I Googled heroin. That is how I found out that what I was messing with was actually physically addicting. I had no idea.
Really? When you were coming into the city in Heroin Highway, where were you finding it? I mean, was it just sort of you knew where the spaces were?
On every corner, on every block. I mean, I know it's still like that now, I'm sure, but this was back in the early 2000s where I think it was around a little bit more. You know, at that time, I heard they've cracked down a little bit on it now. But there wasn't a corner that I couldn't pass, that I couldn't just pull over and buy heroin. You know, it was that easy.
When you realized that you were messing with heroin, when you did the Google search, what was your thought? Were you like, I got to get rid of this? I got to stop doing this? Was it just sort of, I'll put this in the back of my head?
No, it didn't cross my mind to stop, to be honest with you. I just wanted more. I didn't feel good, and I knew that if I got some more, it would make me feel better. I think I had some postpartum depression going on. I had my son, you know, right when I was getting ready to get out of high school. And that's kind of a point in the timeline of my life where I was using, you know, from middle school, you know, it was kind of socially acceptable. I did it because it was fun, you know. And then after, you know, I'd had my son, my life kind of changed. I wanted to go away to school. I had, you know, I had my son now. I had to stay local. A lot of my goals in life I wasn't able to do. You know, for whatever reason, I had some issues going on. I just wasn't feeling good in my own skin. And the heroin made me feel better, and that was the answer for me.
Right.
So I needed to continue to do it because it made me feel good. And it did a good job of doing that, you know. But when I didn't have it, all bets were off.
You mentioned that about your son. And, you know, being a mother addicted to heroin is and trying to find the fix, to try and find to feel better. Mm-hmm. How difficult was that to do being a mother?
If it wasn't for my mom and dad, my son would have been taken from me. Absolutely. I was 17 when I had him. And my mom and dad stepped in, you know, and kind of played the mom and dad role. I wasn't even able to function, you know, as a mother. Plus, I was young anyway at that point. But it became school, college eventually kind of subsided and faded out. Things like that didn't really matter anymore. My main goal every day was to stay high. My biggest fear was not having the next one.
Was your mom and dad aware? Did they know what was happening?
My mom and dad found out that I was doing heroin. I got arrested on the west side, and I called my dad at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he asked me what I got arrested for. They were taking me to Cook County Jail, and I had to tell him. And he was absolutely blown away. He had no idea the extent of it, you know. And then mom and dad went into I can fix this mode. You know, what did we do wrong as a mom and dad? And we can get her better. We can love her enough to save her. They did everything that they could as parents to try to help me. And unfortunately, it did not work.
The experience of being arrested and taken to Cook County Jail, a sobering experience.
Petrifying.
Take us through that.
I had we were on Cicero Avenue, and it was me and a best friend of mine at the time, and we had pulled off onto a side street and copped some dope, and we pulled back onto Cicero Avenue and almost rear-ended an undercover cop. And by the time we looked up, the two cops were getting out of the car. And they said, you know, get out of the car with your hands up. So we got out, and he said, we just saw what you did. Give me the drugs. And I'm like, I don't have any drugs. He's like, we've been watching this spot. He's like, give me the drugs. He said, if I have to call a female officer, I'm going to take you to jail. And it went so, it happened so fast. And I'm thinking, yeah, it sounds good, but if I give this cop my drugs, he's gonna take me anyway. So in a split second, I'm like, okay, here, I'll give it to him. So I gave him to him, and he said, no, it's too late. He said, I already called the female cop. And I remember begging and pleading, please do not take me to Cook County Jail. I was 19 years old. I was from the suburbs, you know, a little white girl going, you know, all I knew about that is stuff you would see on TV. I was petrified, you know, and they were kind of playing good cop, bad cop. I truly believe the one cop, he was telling his partner, like, hey, don't take her, you know. And he's like, nope, it's too late. It's too late. And the police officer let me use his cell phone on the way to West Grand Station, it was. And he said, I'm going to let you use the phone to call somebody because I can't guarantee that you're going to get your phone call when you get down there. And I called my dad, and he said, Jesse, because he said, what's going on, baby girl? And I said, I got arrested with cocaine. I thought that might sound better than heroin for some reason, which is baffling. It was a little more, cocaine was really big back then.
Before. Yeah.
Heroin wasn't as bad then as it is now. The cop got on the phone and told him, you can come get her tomorrow, you know, in the morning about 9 o'clock, 26 in Cal. I don't even know where that was. And I didn't know that next day. They had let me out on an I-bond. I had no prior records at that point. And my dad had drove out there to get me three separate times. Because every time you just wait, you're on their time, basically. And about 7-8 o'clock that night, I walked out and they just put you out. They don't care if you have anywhere to go. And there my dad was standing on the stops waiting for me. And I just remember him throwing his jacket around me and saying, come on, let's go.
What was that experience like to be in that Cook County jail, to be there for as long as you were?
Well, I was there for probably, I'd say, about 24 hours. That was long enough for me. There's about, I think they max out like 80 people in one holding cell, and they write on you like your cattle, you know, numbers and stuff like that. And I remember looking around, and there was these women with black eyes and puking and going to the bathroom on themselves, you know, heroin withdrawal. And I remember looking around and being like, I don't belong here. This is not me. I am not like these people. I need to get out of here. You know, and that's crazy because down the road, that became me.
As a mother, you, of course, as you said about your son, that you were in a position, if your parents were not there, he would have been taken from you.
Yeah.
You have a daughter as well.
I do.
That was a different story, where your daughter was born while you were addicted to heroin.
Yes. When I got pregnant with my daughter, she's four now, I was clean at that time. I was in an outpatient program treatment. In the relationship that I had gotten into, I probably shouldn't have gotten into, with her dad, right? And I think I was sober about 4 months at that time. And knowing that I was pregnant, him and I were not communicating very well. And this thought crossed my mind, well, if I just got messed up once, maybe him and I could have this really good conversation, like this therapeutic talk. And I kind of compare it to when people say, like, oh, I dance better when I'm drunk, or, you know, I tell people how I really feel. That was my default mode. Like, I'm uncomfortable. I don't know how to communicate. I'm going to use. And that thought seemed okay, knowing I was pregnant. I was just going to do it one time. And I did. And nobody knew. You know, I was hiding it really well. And then I did it the following weekend. And then the following weekend after that, and next thing I know, I'm 7 months pregnant, and I'm doing about $100 a day of heroin, and nobody knows. And I can't tell anybody. Because how shameful is that? You know, I mean, I remember talking terrible about people that used to do that. You know, I would never do that, and how dare you? And I had became one of those people. And my mom, being the one that I was probably around throughout the, you know, the whole journey of my addiction, she started to catch on to it. You know, what was in the dark came to the light. And the cat was out of the bag, and at that point, all crap kind of hit the fan. Some people were really angry, you know, at me, and rightfully so. Methadone was the beginning of my recovery story, which is a medicated, you know, treatment. I got on methadone, and that is what helped me get through the withdrawal symptoms, you know, of using. So I didn't use heroin, you know, from 7 months pregnant until I had my daughter, but I was on the methadone. So I stayed in Gateway, and I was doing well. I wasn't using the heroin. I ended up having my daughter, and about 3 days after I had her, she was in the NICU for jaundice. I got a call from the physician, and she said, your daughter's gone into a full-blown acute opiate withdrawal. And I knew that that was a possibility, but I was hoping, because we were going on day number 2 and 3, maybe that we had gotten lucky somehow, but that was not the case. She was in the NICU at Copley Hospital in Aurora for 35 days. And the way that they wean babies off of heroin is with morphine, you know. And she went through withdrawal. It was very difficult to watch, knowing that I had done that to her, you know, and the family around feeling the same way. And usually something like that, based on my past track record, is that would have been a reason for me to say, F it, and I'm going to go get high, because I don't like how I feel, and everybody's mad at me, and something was changing me at that time. I didn't like what was happening. What's done was done. There was nothing I could do about it. What am I going to do from here on out to make things right and to be a better person and get through this? Does it suck? Absolutely. It is what it is. It's unfortunate.
You mentioned, you know, everybody's mad at you and everybody was angry. How about you? Are you angry at yourself?
Yeah, I think anger, you know, too. But I just was getting to the point where I'm like, what is the matter with me? Why do I keep doing this? I just didn't understand. I didn't want to hurt people. I didn't want to run my life into the ground. I didn't want to let my mom and dad down. They didn't raise me that way. What is the matter with me? And that's kind of when I was like, I can't do this on my own. I need some help.
How long have you been clean?
Coming up on 5 years this July. Well, in the beginning, it was definitely harder in the beginning than it is now. It was very, very difficult. Anybody that says that it's not, that is a lie. It was probably one of the hardest things that I ever had to do. I was literally relearning my life all over and how to live life
on life's terms, you know, normally, like quote-unquote normal people do. My go-to for so long was to put something in my system. And I had to walk through that process, talk about some real issues that were going on, that have been going on for years. You know, but treatment is going to end someday. That is, you know, that is the thing. So what was I going to do after I left treatment? Because I had no problem staying sober in jail or staying sober and inpatient. You know, what the problem was, I couldn't maintain sobriety once, you know, I was out in the quote-unquote real world. So I needed to figure something out and get some sort of support network together. Mm-hmm. People that had what I wanted, people that had been through what I had been through, that could show me how to live my life sober. And that gave me hope. And I held on to those people for dear life. I still do today. You know, that's what my social life consists of today. It is not easy. It's definitely learning experiences, but it's worth it.
When you see yourself at the point you're at now, where you are 5 years clean, does the light at the end of the tunnel, is it brighter? Or are you continually, in fear may not be the right word, sure, but in fear of relapse?
Not today. Not today. If I continue to do what I've been doing for the last 5 years, I'm going to be okay because it's been working. Do drugs and alcohol scare me? Absolutely. I have been taught and I understand who I am and what I am today. I don't have the luxury of going and hanging out after a Friday night at the bar and having one drink. That is not how it works for me. So that thought of just one, I'm petrified. I run from it. But it's not a constant battle today. I'm not fighting it constantly like I was in the very beginning. In the beginning, it was, I can't use because, you know, this will happen. Now, I don't want to use today. I'm okay with who I am. I feel okay in my skin today. You know, I don't have to be feeling perfect all the time. That is not realistic. But yeah, I definitely, the light is bright at the end of the tunnel. In the cold, the way to go, you gave me. In a way to come, make it all right. I was here in the world that you gave me. Every time.
Story of Jessica. Little side note, her daughter's healthy. A very powerful story in just the first tonight. Coming up after the news, Tim O'Malley joins us. We'll hear his story, his fight to get clean. It's Extension 720. Stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight, sharing stories of addiction and recovery tonight as part of this episode. And we continue now. Let's move on to a story that is close to my heart, the story of Tim O'Malley. I use Tim's last name because, well, he does. He's been telling his story on stage and to students for years. As a matter of fact, my first teacher in improv way back in the mid-90s. Why does he tell his story? Why does he use his last name? Because it's much of a story about substance abuse and addiction as it is as a cautionary tale. See, Tim was a rising star in the 80s, improvising all over town and getting on stage at Second City. He was following in the footsteps of John Belushi and his friend Chris Farley. Here's a clip of Tim on stage doing a Mount Rushmore musical number at Second City in 1990, alongside his castmates at the time, Bob Odenkirk, Dave Pasquese, and of course, Chris Farley.
Forced to see this country singing, we got no eyes to close.
That's from 1990. That was found. I found it on the Second City Twitter feed a couple years back. Tim wanted nothing more to be on Saturday Night Live. He trained with Del Close. He partied with John Belushi and was paying his dues, just like Farley, Tim Meadows, Bonnie Hunt, and others. But he never got the call. So here's Tim O'Malley telling his story of the ups and downs of being a rock and roll comedian.
You know, I started out as a singer in college and sang with Sean Colvin. I split to Chicago, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do or be. And then people told me I was funny while I was singing in between songs. And they're like, and a girl brought me down to Second City and introduced me to Del's class, Del Close. And next thing you know, I'm passing a bag of mushrooms to the guy that collected money from him, and I was accepted into the class.
What attracted you to that scene?
Well, it was really acting. I had seen Baum and Gilead at Steppenwolf, and it rocked me. And I saw several shows at Second City, and I was like, I found what I wanted to be. And it was a big revelation, because I had three or four friends that knew what they wanted to be, like in high school. So I'm way out of college, flunked out of college, and found what I wanted to be. So it was a big, and I was like, I want to do a show on that stage at Second City, and I want to do a show at Steppenwolf. I still have not achieved the second goal.
But, you got to get that done.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, everyone has this moment when you realize what you want to do. And that's a great thing, especially when it comes to comedy and improv. People, there's some, right now, there's thousands of kids that are saying, I want to do this. I want to be a part of this. But for you, Tim, you were good. And you still are good. But the point being that it wasn't just you were funny. Second City recognized quickly that you were able to handle what was thrown at you on stage as an improviser, as a comedian. You rose the ranks pretty quick. How does your dependency on alcohol in that moment, knowing that there's a lot of successes and there's a lot of failures, there's a lot of highs and there's a lot of lows when it comes to that kind of work? I mean, that's what attracts people to it. How did it manifest itself for you when you were going through the process of rising the ranks?
Well, obviously, Del was way into drugs. I mean, God rest his soul. And, you know, and we, I should say, I, as an alcoholic and a drug addict, heard a message about usage. The more tortured you were, the deeper your work would get. And I was way into acting and learning how to write from Gelman and stuff like that. And so there was this kind of like, several people got it, you know, that got that message from Del. And so it was kind of like, he was a great teacher, but he was also a drug addict and alcoholic. And he spoke to us about like the dark side. You know, it's like James Joyce or any great writer. Like, people think they have to have this tortured soul to have any depth to their work. I think it speaks to the alcoholic and the drug addict.
So you almost, in a way, saw it as an asset.
Oh, yeah. John Belushi comes in, he signs an autograph on my back, he sits in on classes, and, you know, one lucky student gets to, you know, hang out with Del and John while they shoot heroin. And, you know, I was really jealous of the person that was allowed to do that. And later on, when he opened the Blues Bar, it was like, here's John, and he's tossing out grams to everybody. And, you know, I'm like sitting there like a dog, and I get to sing Louie Louie with him. That's drugs and the entertainment mixed together in my mind is a big fantasy, and it just enhances it.
Being a part of the comedy community and understanding the relationship between comedy and drugs and alcohol, I mean, all you have to do is go across the street to the bars. You'll see the paintings on the wall of some of the icons that have played at Second City. Mostly because they hung out in that bar, and they hung out till 5 o'clock in the morning. We glorify it. We almost think of it as like this. What a golden age! What a golden time for comedy!
Yeah, it is. There is an aggrandizing of those people. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
I mean, at least firemen don't go to a bar and see great dead alcoholic firemen on the wall, but they go to a bar where their grandfather was a fireman and they drank. Or cops go to a bar where their grandfather was a cop and they drank. And, you know, the funny thing is, there was a cop a lieutenant. I don't know his remember his name. I got great cop stories. But he grabbed me towards my bottom, and he said, "You don't belong here, Tim. You got to get your life back together." And then another fireman, he was chief of the fire chief at the time of Chicago. He was another guy sitting at that same bar. It was filled with cops, Vietnam vets, and people from Beverly. And I was hitting bottom. And both those guys were like, "You got to get your life back together. You got a problem right now, and you shouldn't be at this bar."
A lot of your story, and we've talked about this before, but has to do with rejection. I mean, there was a time where you saw a lot of your cast members be picked to go to New York or L.A. to become stars on Saturday Night Live or other places, and you were passed over. How much do you think that your dependency and your addiction played a role in both being passed over and how you reacted to being passed over?
Well, I mean, it's an emotional disorder as well as a mental illness. I mean, I talk about it at meetings. You know, if you look up mental illness, alcoholism is number one. And people don't understand that it is a mental illness. Anyway, so I'm emotionally stunted, right? At the time I started to fully drink and was 10, so I'm stuck in 10. And I don't know how to process disappointment. I've never been taught how to process emotions. No one ever talked about emotions or how to process them in my family. I'm not blaming them. It just wasn't part of our language. For me, as an alcoholic, like not getting something, and you talked about the ups and downs of trying to get to where you want to be in life. Yeah, the emotionally stunted person will drink more when they get disappointed or when they don't get what they want. And they literally don't have the faculties. Like everybody that I knew that was graduating from the main stage at Second City was in the process of writing a sitcom, learning how to write a movie. All my peers, you know, Joel and Bonnie, and they were all working on voiceover stuff, getting ready for what's next. And I had one goal. I put all my eggs in one basket. I had myopic view of working on Saturday Night Live. And I didn't have the knowledge, and no one taught me, you know, keep doing, you know, keep a lot of irons out there like I do now, and don't count on one thing. And the inability to cope with not getting that, it was the beginning of my end. I was 3 more years, but it was down.
For you, what are we talking about? I mean, you're just drinking to excess? I mean,
no, I'm drinking and doing coke, you know, the whole time. You know, I'm hanging out with the big boys. All the stars that were on some of those on SNL were coming to town. And we'd hang out till 7 in the morning doing coke, you know, after the bars closed. You know, so there's 4 or 5 of us that are doing, you know, just trying to keep up with the big boys. We're addicted, so we're doing it as much as possible. But we're also like feel like we're the coolest people on the planet because we're sitting in the room. And, you know, we're a star because they're a star. And then when you end up in a room with, well, I won't name names anyway. But, you know, like, you can realize somewhere along the way, it's like, this isn't right. You know, some of my friends were missing some, and I was missing weddings and stuff like that. And I lost a girl, and one of my sisters said, you know, don't double your drinking just because you lost a girl. You know, and I didn't really lose the girl. She kicked me out because of my addictions. She was like, don't double up. And the first thought I had was, oh, that's what I'll do. That's my solution, double up. And so instead of cocktail size, I had pint glasses full of Myers and Coke.
Do you point to a moment in your life where you finally recognized that you needed to be sober? Was there a moment where you said, I need to get into treatment?
I was living in my dad's basement and hopeless and having vague thoughts of jumping in front of a train, you know, because I didn't see any way out. I was like, I'm a loser. I'm living in my dad's. I'm never going to get back to the theater. It had been 3 years. And one morning, my little sister called me a month after Christmas and said, I found your crack pipe and I don't want you to die. And she cried and I cried and I sat in the kitchen floor crying with my little sister. That was the moment. It was Jean calling me that day, and I was in treatment a week later. I mean, the story is, you know, I'm in my dad's basement dying and stealing from him to get enough money just to buy drinks and try to, you know, get to the next bar, which was always possible, and then had no hope. And I was complete, like, no responsibility, no accountability. That was the main things they were trying to teach us when we got there. to 4 months later being on stage in Ireland with Bill Murray, his brothers, all my cohorts, against the wishes of one of my friends in recovery who was with us, who said, "Don't come here. This is the Disneyland of drinking. This is, you can't come here 4 months over." But it's hard to explain, like waking up at 5:30 in the morning at Gateway and looking out the window at all the geese on the lake and realizing one morning, like, this is my only chance. Like, I've been given a second chance. And then all of a sudden there's this overwhelming feeling like I can live again. Like, this is possible. And then trying to commit myself as best I could to doing what everybody told me to do. And then, you know, telling someone that I was in Ireland performing again. And in that short period of time and have that happen. I mean, it's God telling me I'm on the right track.
Tim O'Malley, great to see you, man.
Great to see you too, Justin.
Tim O'Malley, longtime Chicago comedian. Check out his show, God Show, which was all about his experience with substance abuse, addiction, and recovery. Tim continues to teach and act and create comedy. And, of course, tell his story to the Chicago comedy community, whoever will listen, about the role that drugs and alcohol play. More to come tonight as we explore drug abuse, substance abuse, addiction, and recovery on Extension 720. Stay with us. It is Extension 720 here on WGN. I am Justin Kaufman, and this, of course, is episode 19, an episode we're calling A Long Way Back to the Light, as we feature stories of addiction and recovery. Thank you to our partners at Gateway Foundation tonight, as they gave us access to not only their counselors, but to alumni of the program to talk about their journeys and their story with both addiction and sobriety. So let's continue. Our next story tonight is a story that's shared by mother and daughter, Pam and her daughter, Melissa. Both have had a past with addiction, substance abuse. They come from a family that has had addiction issues. Same warning applies, adult situations in this piece. We start with Pam.
My fight with substances started with a prescription from a doctor. I went in for a normal routine surgery, and I ended up addicted to the pain medication because of it. And so at the worst of my addiction, I ended up with 10 doctors prescribing me medication.
T
Did you at the time know the dangers of this? Did you, going through the surgery and being prescribed pain pills, were you educated on what could possibly happen?
No, the education wasn't there at all when I first went in. I just went in, I had the surgery, I took the pain pills as anybody else would have. That's why I know the addiction is a disease piece is a fact. Because no, you know, people have that first drink when they're 21. I had that first drink when I was 21 and I never went home. I didn't go home for 30 years.
Obviously, you're talking about the pain pills. And have you had trouble with other substances as well? Or was it just this this pain pill that was introduced to you?
No, once the addiction took off, it was addiction is the middle, and the pain pills were a symptom of the addiction. So it was gambling. It was the pain pills. It was anything that I do. I can't do just a little bit of it.
When you were in the middle of it, when you were going through this, were you aware?
I absolutely was aware, but I was also at the point where I was using against my own will because I didn't want to be sick. So it was either, you know, it's a planned illness. So when do I have time between raising kids and a business to have a planned illness? And I just never seemed to find the time to do that.
How old was your daughter at this time?
They never really had a completely sober mom. I never used while I was pregnant. I was a hands-on mom, but I was never, like, all the way there. You know, I was more financial with my kids than I ever was emotionally. We're lucky we had the means because I was able to have a nanny at home with the kids. Because otherwise, the same thing would have happened to me that happens to other women. Somebody would have took my kids. And they should have. Because I was not there hands-on with them. After the addiction, then came the kids. And it's always after the addiction when you're addicted.
Let me bring in your daughter. That story that's being told, and you're in the room with us, is that accurate? Do you see it from your vantage point that it was a transaction or a financial relationship, not an emotional one, that your mom was an addict first and a mom second?
Absolutely. You know, growing up, I was a firsthand. I seen it, especially being the youngest of all the kids. You know, I was always the one that kind of sat in the background and I observed everything. And growing up, that is how it was. You know, I mean, we didn't need or want for anything besides for time and a connection. And in our family, it wasn't a secret. It was just kind of a way of life in a sense. You know, it was my mom, older brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, you name it. It was just kind of a way of life in my family.
Being a kid and growing up with that, do you remember the feelings that you attached to that? Were you sad? Were you angry? Resentful? What was it that you saw or felt when you saw the things around?
It didn't really make me angry. It made me motivated in a sense. And when I was younger, it made me all the more determined to not be that way. In a way, you know, and for a long time I didn't, you know, I was very hands-on, you know, I worked, went to school, excelled, you know, and that's why for me personally, addiction didn't come on till much later in life, you know, because I had that front row seat where I was like, man, you know, like I don't ever want to be like that, you right. know, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that I don't turn out the same way.
How did it start for you?
For me, it was, you know, a lot of it I think had to do with boredom, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, hanging out with the wrong people, making just poor choices, hanging out with the wrong boy, you know, and just graduated high school and I had like that big chunk of free time, you know, and just one thing kind of led to another and that was it. And once I made that choice, you know, it started small, you know, like smoking weed and then kind of drinking. And, you know, it wasn't like I just like went right for the hard stuff.
Right, right.
You know, it was started small and it eventually progressed.
When do you recall making that move from the smaller stuff to the hard stuff?
When I was about 19, you know, I started, you know, dabbling with cocaine a little bit. And I remember distinctively, you know, every single time I would do it, I absolutely hated it. And that's what kind of like, when I think back now that I'm in recovery, it makes me really identify like, wow, I'm definitely an addict because I hated it every single time I would do it. But yet I would do it anyway. You know, like who does that? You know, like you hate the way it makes you feel, every part about it, but you just keep doing it. You know, just because it was there, it was around you, so you just keep doing it.
So you're doing that, and you're hating doing it, but you continued to mm-hmm. do it, and you continued on to other drugs, right. and continued on. So pick it up there.
I continued that for maybe about a year and a half. Kept doing it for about a year continuously, about every day. Ended up having to check myself in to a mental hospital because I gave myself cocaine psychosis. Completely just lost my mind. And that was what it took for me to be like, you know what, I'm never touching that drug again. No way. And at that point, I was like, let me try something else. Maybe I won't get that effect. And that was when I started doing opiates. And I started with pain pills. And I knew from the minute I took a couple pain pills from then on that was going to be a long road for me.
Pam, just hearing that, it sounds familiar to the story you told about the prescription drugs and the pills and continuing. Does that resonate with you to hear your daughter talk about that moment where she decided opiates and decided to go in that direction?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first prescription she got was after a surgery, and I seen myself in that so much. And I remember sitting down with her and telling her, Melissa, be careful. It's a very slippery slope with opiates, especially because we have addiction in our family. I told her that you can become addicted. You know, I failed to tell her that it's a mental addiction before it's a physical addiction, and that was the one thing that I asked her that I could have done differently. And I have a 15-year-old now, so I do that differently. I let him know you're mentally, you know, before you're physically addicted. So I understand exactly when that decision came into play. It's for me, I never felt so good in my life when it first started, because it's always fun when it first starts. It ends up not fun at the end, but I can't tell you that it wasn't fun in the beginning, because that would be a lie.
Were you aware at the time when you're making a transition to opiates, the fight that your mom was going through or had gone through?
No, because at that point, I mean, our relationship was pretty strained. I mean, really, until I was about 24, 25, our relationship wasn't that good. Really, until I got into recovery, was it till then did we have a relationship that we have to this day where we really communicate. And, you know, now she is one of my best friends, you know, and we talk about everything. But back then, I mean, I didn't really listen.
When was the rock bottom moment for you? As your mom said, it starts out fun, but then it goes bad. And for you, it's a similar story. So take us to the point where you realize that you need help.
Rock bottom for me was, you know, I was 25 years old. I started using when I was 19. So it was about an 8-year period. You know, it progressed from just casual using all the way up to IV heroin use. I was homeless, you know, walking the streets, overdosing left and right. I weighed maybe about 100 pounds. And I knew for probably about 3 months until I got clean that, like, the end was coming. You know, either I was going to die or I was going to get clean. There was no middle ground. I was just kind of in an internal battle with myself of getting to the point of being able to physically put the drugs down. And it wasn't so much of, like a physical rock bottom. It was more of an emotional, spiritual rock bottom for me. I could not live that way anymore. Mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, I couldn't go on. My body couldn't handle it. My mind couldn't handle it. I burnt everything to the ground.
When you tell this story, what is the emotion that comes up with it? To tell it the story to people who might be listening, that you were homeless, that you were walking the street at 24 years old, addicted to heroin.
You know, the reason why I do it is because recovery is my life, 100%. You know, I live it, I breathe it, so that person that's out there doing it can know that there is hope. Because I was that person, and so many people looked at me and was like, there's no way that this girl's going to make it. She's not going to make it through. I was the girl that checked into treatment, and people were like, she's never going to get this. That desperation, that despair, those feelings, and the pain that I felt 4.5 years ago, when I think about it, I still feel that. And I think if I ever lost it, that would be a very dangerous place for me to be. because that's what keeps me clean, is remembering that pain like it was yesterday. Mm. You know, and a lot of people ask me all the time, you know, they're like, you know, what you know, talking about it, like, aren't you scared that people are going to judge you or people are, you know, and honestly, I couldn't care less, because even if it helps one person to know, you know what I mean? Like, that was me. Absolutely, that was who I was. I did some things I wasn't proud of. I've been through some things I wasn't proud of, absolutely. But you know what? That doesn't have to be who I become in spite of it all.
Listening to your daughter tell that story and to carry that pain with her, how does that make you feel, knowing that pain?
Whenever she's in pain, it's like I can feel her pain. You know, I remember one of the eye-opening things that somebody, she had shared. I remember her stating that her friends threw in the alley like trash. And I left that meeting and I cried for 2 days, because I know that was just, that had to be horrible. And even now, it's just to see my child in that kind of pain, and to even carry that she's seen me doing that stuff first, you know, and then it caused her to have that kind of pain. That was a lot to deal with.
Is that something you had to deal with, to somewhat take responsibility for it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have no problem saying, you know, like a lot of mothers, they don't want to take responsibility. Look, I did what I did. I messed up. I wasn't there. I have no problem saying that out loud. I can't change any of it, but what I can do is move forward and be a better mother at this point and be here for my daughter. And guilt and shame will get you high. So I had to get rid of guilt and shame, because if I didn't, I would again be taking prescription pain pills, because I would not want to feel that.
That's such a great way to think about it, that guilt and shame will get you high.
It will absolutely get you high.
And that's from first-person experience. But for you, I mean, that as we talk about this tonight on this program, that seems to be a key component, this idea of guilt and shame and how that drives people almost away from getting help.
Well, the reason I use is because I didn't want to feel. So the last thing I want to feel is guilt or shame. So if I don't nip that in the bud right away, then I'm going to use. And I already know that.
For both of you, what does it mean to have each other after this journey, which is in such a short amount of time? I mean, we're only talking about a couple of decades when you really think about it. But the two of you have lived what seems to be 100 lives.
Oh, to have my daughter at this stage in my life, I wouldn't want anything else. I'm there for her. I can understand her. I can empathize with her, because I know she can call me up sometimes, or I can call her up and say, I'm feeling some type of way. And in recovery, when someone calls you and says they're feeling some type of way, that means you better talk to them, because they're thinking about getting high. They don't say that, but it's an unspoken language in recovery. So to be able to have a relationship with somebody that I love so much, and to be able to be just so honest with her, I could never replace that relationship.
And for me, it's being able to have this relationship with my mother now, you know, it means a lot to me, you know, especially because it's something that was missing for such a large part of my life. You know, now that I'm able to have it, you know, it's something that I don't take for granted. And also because I was out there doing the same thing, I have a different understanding how, you know, all the resentment and all the anger and everything I held on to for so long from when I was younger, you know, it was so much easier to be able to let go of once I did get clean. It made me be able to understand, like, wow, you know, like, I understand, like, how you were able to do the things that you did, you know, like, I get it. If I were you, I probably would have done even worse.
Things change.
Thanks to Pam and Melissa for telling their stories, mother and daughter here on Extension 720. More to come. We'll hear the story of Connor coming up right after the 9:30 news. So stay with us. Okay, so let's get to our final story tonight as we've been exploring addiction and recovery and sobriety here on the program all night long, hearing stories of alumni from Gateway Foundation as well as the counselors earlier in the show talking about some of the issues and changes in how we even talk about substance abuse and addiction and recovery. But our final story tonight features Connor. Connor isn't talking about his ancient story with drugs and alcohol. No, Connor's story is new. 25-year-old has been sober for a short time, and it took only a short time for him to get here. After starting early and continuing his drinking, he realizes he needed help, and he finally got it. Our last story. Here's Connor.
My mom is one of 10, big Irish Catholic family. So drinking was always, I'd say, a big part of the family parties. I was never really around any alcoholics, but it was just a norm growing up, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, people would be drinking. It would never get too out of hand, but that was normal for me.
And when did you start?
I started in, I'd say, 7th grade. By 8th grade, it was pretty consistent, most weekends. High school, you know, just continued to progress a little bit. Until college, I was drinking almost every day.
So when you're in 7th and 8th grade, what are we talking about? Are you sneaking away? I mean, is this something that is social with your friends that you're experimenting with alcohol?
Yeah, we get somebody's older brother or somebody to, you know, get us a bottle or a case. And it started off, you know, one Friday a month or random weekends. We didn't know how to drink, so we'd just get plastered. And that turned into, by 8th grade, you know, most weekends. And then high school, it was pretty consistently once or twice a weekend.
It's not like you're going to think that you have a problem anymore. This was social and it was fun for you.
Right. And then even when it started to progress later, the last couple of years, I still used the youth excuse. So when I was 21, 22, 23, I wasn't doing really anything outside of what people my age were doing. Most people were doing very similar things. It's just when I would drink, I would go above and beyond. And I didn't realize that. And then I would keep surrounding myself with people who did similar things. So once that progression kept going, I would surround myself with people who drank like me. Mm-hmm. So then I would look around and say, you know, I'm just doing what everyone else is doing. And it didn't seem to be a problem.
What do you mean when you say drink like me?
Get consistently blacked out, drink early in the morning if it came to that, you know, 12-hour days on a nice day party, into the wee hours of the night, stuff like that.
You'll hear from a lot of people who drink or used to drink like you that it starts off to be social and party, and there's a point where your personality changes or that you change to your friends. Was that happening to
you? Most definitely. Like I said, in high school, before that, even in college, it was pretty innocent. I didn't have any consequences until college age. So high school, you know, I never got in trouble. My grades were decent, got into a good school. I went to ISU. You know, even then, I didn't have any consequences. So that was the big thing. Once I started getting consequences, maybe I took another look at myself, but it wasn't until, you know, I got a DUI, got a fake ID ticket, you know, damaged to property. Once I started getting arrested a couple times, then I started to realize there was a problem. But before then, you know, if I didn't have any consequences, I'd still probably be out there.
And it's such an interesting reason I ask is because, you know, a lot of the stories that we hear, even with this program, will be about people who got to a certain age and they've been sober for a long time, but they didn't make that determination in their life until much later. For you to be as young as you are and to make a change in your life, how did it come about? Are we talking about, were you aware of your problem? Did you have friends who were like, hey, Connor, you gotta get together? Or was it sort of an enabling culture that you were a part of?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I didn't really have friends come out and say straight up that I had a problem. I was big into coke, too. There was people who voiced their concerns, but they never went farther than, you know, you seem to be doing a lot of drugs. Is everything okay? That was the extent of it. And then I started going to a program when I was 22, maybe, not consistently at all, just to, I'd say, get my mom off my back and say I was doing something about it. But the disease is progressive, but getting sober, I'd say, is progressive too. It's not one event that happens where you make the decision It's, I think, a couple things that lead up to it. And at first, you know, you're not all the way into it. And then you're, you know, maybe I want to get sober, but I don't want to do the steps to take me there. And then it's, you know, I have to. It's more of a need than a want. I was all over the place. I couldn't really keep a job. I had a really good job with sales that I was in for a little over a year, but I was making more money than I ever had, which kind of wasn't great for me. I could see my progression now as I would, as the year went on, I just used more and more, drank more and more. My behavior was pretty erratic, and I didn't realize it at the time, but that was just a precursor for me, you know, going on a huge bender pretty much every weekend. And then one event that did really change everything was I got hit by a car Memorial Day last year. And that really, that was the last thing that made me want to get sober. Probably the biggest.
You got hit by a car?
Yeah, I was walking home from a friend's Memorial Day party. Probably 12 hours straight of drinking, maybe 25 beers in me. And got hit by a car, ended up in the hospital. Don't know how I got there. I woke up getting my head stitched. I had two broken bones in my neck, my C3 and my C4. And 2 days after I got out of the hospital, I went to Gateway.
Take us through, you said you were benders every weekend. When you're at the height of that, what does that look like?
When I say bender, I'm talking, you know, I get off of work Friday, start drinking all night, wake up early, smoke a little weed, maybe do some coke to get back up, drink more. Saturday, Sunday, same thing. Come down Sunday, sleep it off, go back to work on Monday.
How is your friends, your culture, everything around it? Because I would assume that at your age and what you're talking about, there is a group that does this kind of thing. Is it difficult to go through recovery when that's probably still happening?
I'd say so. So my friends, my long-term friends from high school, they never really got into the stuff I was in. So, I mean, they would drink a lot. They still drink now. You know, we're still 25 years old, so they go out. But I had this other group of friends where we would, you know, get into a little bit more shenanigans. And I know, you know, I know what they're still up to. I'm not stupid. I don't really talk to them as much anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm still very close with my friends from high school, and they're super supportive. And I do, you know, make time to see them. But it is difficult knowing, you know, people are going out on a Friday and, you know, they'll invite me, but I know it's going to be odd to be there for more than an hour if I just get uncomfortable, or, you know, they don't want to get too wasted in front of me. But, you know, I'm lucky. I have a great group of supporting friends and family.
A lot of it is reworking or rewiring your friendships.
Most definitely.
Because those friendships, and like you said, they're running with a certain crew that you don't run with anymore, that might be what brings you guys together. How hard is that at a young age to do, to rewire, to rework your friendships?
There's a saying, you know, in sobriety that you're the last to know. So, you know, your family knows, your friends know that you have a problem. They all knew I had a problem. You know, they didn't really voice their concerns, but they, you know, in retrospect, I've had conversations with them where they're like, yeah, you were out of control. They're not going to try to control me. They knew they couldn't, but they did know I had a problem, and we had to, instead of going out on a Friday, we'll go to brunch on a Sunday, you know, or instead of going to the bar or, you know, a Cubs game and getting wasted, we'll go to GameWorks or something. We'll find something to do. If the friendship is that real, then, you know, you'll work past it.
In this process, and you said it is a process, it's not something you just come to a realization, you have a process of getting it. How much did you trust the process, you know, because you mentioned right at the beginning that you're like, did it because your mom was on your back. How much do you have to buy in and accept the process as opposed to just kind of going in because that's what you're supposed to do?
To be honest, when I went to rehab at Gateway, I was not bought in one bit. I did it because I didn't really have a choice. I spent a month there, and then I spent 2 months at a halfway house in Des Plaines. And, you know, even after that month in rehab, I still wasn't completely bought in. I was at the First Step House, which is an AA recovery house. And, you know, I was required to get two sponsors. I was required to hit a meeting every single day. And I kind of faked it until I made it. I worked the steps. I wasn't completely bought in. You know, there's a God concept that I struggled with, and I did what people told me to do, and I trusted that they knew better than what I knew, because I knew that I couldn't control my life. My life was extremely unmanageable, so I faked it until I made it, and then there came a point where it was just like, you know, maybe 3 months sober, where it was like, okay, this is a lot better. I could already see my life improving, my relationships are better, and, you know, if I actually put everything into it, then this will get a lot better.
And what didn't you buy into? What was it that was keeping you from going in?
So I knew my life was unmanageable. I had all these arrests. I couldn't really keep a job. But there was a part of me that thought I could control my drinking or my drug use, which, if history shows, I definitely couldn't. But there was just a part of me that I didn't completely buy it. And then there's, you know, a higher power concept that I struggled with. I've never really been too religious, and it's not religion at all, you know, this program. But, you know, hearing the God word, it's it kind of freaks you out. And, you know, it took me a while to buy into it. But once I did, it's been, you know, just uphill from there.
To be as young as you are, to be in recovery, to be sober, it's got to be tough, not just with your set of friends, but whether or not you want to branch out and try to find new friends or dating or whatever it might be. At such a young age, you have to explain your story to people, a story that they may connect to an older generation, someone who might be gone through more of life. So how is that when you're trying to do the things that 25-year-olds do being sober?
So I'm extremely grateful of the situation I've been put in. The first step house where I got sober for 2 months, there's a pretty big group of guys around my age. So I have, you know, 6 or 7 buddies within a couple of years of me who, you know, we go to meetings together. There's an Oasis group that, you know, it's at Oasis in Niles, and it's a young people's sobriety group. It's not affiliated with any AA or NA, but it's people who want to get sober. And it's a great way to meet people, you know, around your age and just try to connect with people. Because I know when I was getting sober, I was so put off by the idea that it was a bunch of old white dudes who had 25 years of sobriety that I couldn't relate with. And then when I got in the rooms and it was 26-year-old kid with 2 years of sobriety who I could talk to and was in the same bar I was in, probably, you know, it made it a lot easier to open up and to use that experience for my gain. And then there was, you know, another group at the Alano Club in Des Plaines who set up sober volleyball, which is where I met my girlfriend, who is a year and a half sober now almost. So I've been really fortunate that I'm around so many people my age that I could rely on.
It's been a year. How has your life changed?
So I'm actually teaching now. I teach special ed. I have, you know, another job driving. I have another job at a gym. So I have 3 jobs. I'm pretty busy. My relationship with my family is better than it's ever been. I could go out and not get 100 calls about where I'm at, what I'm doing. You know, I have a girlfriend now who's sober. It's probably the best relationship I've ever had. And more than anything, I'm just happy. I'm content with where I'm at. I feel like I'm a valued member of society. I'm not just draining everybody. And I feel good.
Keep on going.
What a night of stories of addiction and recovery. Thanks to Connor. Thanks to Pam and Melissa. Thanks to Tim O'Malley. Thanks to Jessica. Thanks to the counselors and directors at Gateway Foundation for their help in not only telling their story, but giving us access to those stories. We appreciate that, and I know the WGN Radio listeners appreciate that as well.